This is CBS Eye on the World. From the surface of the planet Earth, we're going to the surface of the planet Mars. Now and again, Ingenuity, the brave little flying toaster. Bob Zimmerman is here, keeps the website Behind the Black. Following Ingenuity, way exceeding the back of the envelope for a helicopter on Mars. Bob, how many is this and what did we learn? Good evening to you.
Good evening, Joseph. Ingenuity, earlier this week, completed its 56th flight. It's been doing this now for 2 years. It was only supposed to do maybe a half a dozen test flights in 30 days, and that would test the program and prove it could work. They proved it could work so well that they can use it, and they fly it. And they're now using it for scouting missions for Perseverance. Nothing very ambitious, but basically scout out the surface of the ground where Perseverance is going to travel. Maybe give it the Perseverance team a little idea of what rocks to look at. That's how they're using it. But they're using it, and this is engineering tests. It's really remarkable. 56 flight. It flew about 1,300 some odd feet to the northwest. I've got a map on Behind the Black so you can get some perspective about where it is, where Perseverance is, where to have traveled, and where they're going. What's really cool about this is that on the same day they revealed the data on where it flew and how it flew on the 56th flight, they released their flight plan for the 57th flight, which should happen this coming weekend, if everything goes well. And they're going to fly further to the north along the planned route of Perseverance. Once again, scouting ahead for Perseverance, giving an idea of what the ground will look like. This is an amazing achievement, John, and the engineers should be very, very proud. They've now demonstrated unequivocally that a helicopter on Mars can work and work routinely. And in doing so, they have come up with the engineering, the software, and the techniques for doing so in the future.
Science fiction or science fact? An interstellar object invading another solar system. This is really cool, Bob. What do we know?
We don't know much, and as is usual with science, if you report it accurately. But what happened is some scientists looked back at some data from the military. The U.S. Space Command had detected an object coming in 2014 near Papua New Guinea in the Pacific, and its angle of approach and speed had the U.S. Space Command convinced to a certainty of 99.999% that the object was interstellar in origin. Now it landed in the ocean. So some scientists put together a project to see if they could use what they called a magnetic sled to drag across the seafloor to pick up objects from the seafloor with the hope they'd get some of the objects from this object. And their drag operation took place over the last few months. Last year, and they also dragged regions outside the drop zone so they could get some control. And they picked up a lot of material, and of that material, they've analyzed 57 small spheroids, they call them, and they've determined based on the chemistry of those pieces, tiny, tiny pieces of rock, that they are interstellar in nature. I will tell you right off the bat that one must take this with a grain of salt. There's a lot of disagreement in the science community and skepticism of these results. A lot of skepticism saying that, these are just another typical meteorite, nothing interstellar about it. So there's dispute. There's no doubt about that. That's what science is all about. The scientists that do think this is interstellar speculate that they could have come from the crust of an exoplanet, the core collapse of a supernova, the merger of two supernovas, and get this, possibly, quote, an extraterrestrial technological origin. Of course, they have no idea. That just was really cool conclusions that will, of course, attract attention from journalists like me. I'm just going to point out how skeptical the results are.
Boy, I'd read the second chapter of that science fiction story. All right, we go to Pragyan and Vikram. What are those, Bob?
All right, we're on the moon in a number of different ways, and Pragyan is the rover that India sent to the moon, and Vikram is the lander that brought it there, and they're both operating on the moon. They've got about 4 or 5 more days before the sun sets, and at that point, it's unlikely they'll survive the 14-day lunar night, so this is their moment in the sunlight in more ways than one. And so along the way, Pragyan's been roving about nearby Vikram, and so They've taken pictures of each other. Pragyan took a picture of Vikram, and you could see, I've got the picture on Behind the Black, and you can see the various probes that are into the ground, including a seismograph and the probe that read the temperature of the nearby on the ground surface. And then there's then Vikram took a short movie of Pragyan doing a spin on the surface. Pragyan was going forward. It saw that it was going to move into a crater they didn't want it to move into, so they did rotated it, and Vikram got a video of that. In every case, must remember this mission is an engineering test mission more than anything else. They're getting some science, but what they're really doing is demonstrating the ability to do this stuff. So rolling Pragyan around has as much to do with learning how to operate and autonomously a rover on another world for Indian engineers, because if they want to do more ambitious rover missions elsewhere, like Mars, and they put them orbit around Mars, well, this is how they learn how to do it. And so this whole mission is demonstrating India's increased capabilities to join the big spacefaring nations.
Roscosmos' ambition to land on the moon at a high latitude failed with a crash. Now, location of the crash. Anything significant here, Bob?
It's not so much significant as it's just important, just good data to get. So after the Russians announced it had crashed and gave an approximate location, the science team for Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the American orbiter that's been orbiting the moon now for what, almost 15 years plus, maybe 20, they used it to take a picture of the area. And they then were able to compare that picture with an earlier picture from June of 22, and they saw there was a new impact at that spot, and based on the size and the location, they think this is Luna 25's impact point, the crash point. And I've got a picture on Behind the Black, shows the close-up of that that impact, and it also shows the location on the moon compared to where it was supposed to land in the high southern latitudes. It failed. Luna 25 failed because during its last orbital adjustment to lower the orbit into the right orbit to descend to the surface, the engines fired for too long, and instead of adjusting the orbit, it deorbited the spacecraft. And apparently the spacecraft was not ready to get deorbited to do its landing maneuvers, so instead it just hit the surface and at the wrong spot. And that's a tragedy for Russia. There was talk of rebuilding this, except they're probably not going to be able to rebuild it. As you told me, John, the technology that made Luna 25 was very old. It had been under construction for almost 20 years. And so to rebuild it now would be involving technology that's not used anymore. And so it's not likely Russia will rebuild it.
I contribute one more piece. This is from Anatoly Zak of Russian Space Web. Rumor, okay? Rumor is that because Luna 25 was in orbit approximately the same period that the Indian spacecraft was in orbit, both intending to soft land on the surface of the moon, the Russian management gave orders to beat the Indians to the surface. Hence, there was some freelancing, and that led to what you just identified, the engine misfiring, and it hit the surface in a ballistic fashion. That's a rumor. There's an investigation underway. But given the conditions of the world right now, I doubt if we'll get transparency on the results.
Yeah, I agree with you there, John. Absolutely.
We move on to the James Webb Space Telescope. Bob, there's a really cool piece in Nature magazine. I'm a little behind, several weeks, but it shows the six galaxies spotted by Webb that are total puzzles to cosmologists, not only because their redshift is so deep, but because of their odd shapes and the suggestion of complex galaxies very early in the cosmos after the Big Bang. So I take James Webb to be searching the heavens for things that confound the smart guys.
Didn't do it this time, John. In fact, it actually illustrates the limitations of Webb, this image, to my mind. So what they did is they aimed Webb's infrared capabilities, high-resolution infrared, and aimed it at supernova 1987A. This is the closest supernova since Galileo. There hasn't been a supernova within the Milky Way since before the invention of the telescope, which is unfortunate. But this specific supernova in 1987 took place in the Large Magellanic Cloud, only 168,000 light years away. So it's absolutely pretty close, and we've been watching it evolve over the last what is it, 4 decades, using space telescopes. It's been pretty remarkable research and learning quite a bit about how a supernova post-explosion evolves. And so they decided, let's aim and get an infrared high-resolution image. Now, this is an high-resolution image. It's not the first infrared images of the supernova. The Spitzer Space Telescope is infrared, but it had much lower resolution. It took images. So this infrared image shows some new, one basic new feature, a small crest line structure. And that wasn't seen by Spitzer. It didn't have the resolution. But I got to say, in general, it's a really important example of the capability of Webb. It's a little bit disappointing that Webb didn't find more unusual features at the higher resolution. It just indicates that we're looking at clouds, and, you know, clouds by nature are fuzzy, so higher resolution is not necessarily going to show you that much difference.
What's the keyhole, Bob? Is that the black hole there?
The keyhole is what is this keyhole name, I don't know where they came up with it. It's a bad name because it's not a keyhole. This is the inner ejecta. This is the inner material that is expanding away from the black hole. And it was a small dot 20 years ago, and then it became a cloud, and now it's almost filled the inner ring. The ring that surrounds it is actually material that was there before, but the initial wave of energy lit it up about, I'd say, in the mid-90s. So it's visible because the wave of material that's going through it has activated, caused a lot of energetic events that light it up. But that inner ejecta material is the actual star material, the exploded star that's expanding out, the actual material, not just energy. And it's been moving closer and closer to that outer ring. It's getting close, and that's where it's going to be interesting when it hits.
This is the closest supernova we have since telescopes. That's what I'm looking at.
You're talking of the Webb image. Yes, it's the closest one since telescopes were invented. If one would happen in the Milky Way, it would be spectacular science that would be obtained from it, but it hasn't happened. So
No problem, Bob. We're in business to order the impossible. That's what we're after.
Okay.
All right, now we go to the surface of Mars, where Bob is looking for features that we cannot interpret from Earth's analogy. What have you seen, Bob?
There's one image I've got, a very cool image from a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter of this weird meandering ridges that are peeking up through very soft, thick layers of dust. They look kind of like the rimstone dams you'd see in caves. But it's not clear that's the case. We are looking undeniably at topography and bedrock buried by this sand. The location is inside Juvente Chasma, which is one of those deep chasms or depressions near Valles Marineris. And Juvenente by itself is 3 to 5 times deeper than the Grand Canyon and comparable in size. But you could stand on the rim of Juvenente, look down at its base, and you'd be looking down a depth 3 to 5 times bigger than the Grand Canyon. It's quite spectacular, John.
Bob Zimmerman, he keeps the website Behind the Black. We're going space engineering. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Mack.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor